Thanks for joining us for another episode of Fraud Talk. I'm Emily Primo, assistant editor of Fraud Magazine, and I'm joined by Robert Church, director of healthcare investigations at Forensic Strategic Solutions. Robert will be discussing a healthcare fraud scheme that took place at DaVita Healthcare Partners in Colorado. In the end, DaVita paid $389 million to settle criminal and civil anti-kickback investigations and ended joint ventures with kidney doctors at 28 dialysis clinics. Why don't you start by telling us about how you became aware of the DaVita and Total Renal Care case and just about the case in general?
These types of cases occur routinely. Most of them are filed under seal. This one is no exception to that, and this one became unsealed sometime in mid-September, I believe, or maybe early October. So when it became unsealed, it hit the news. Everybody began to take a pretty strong look at what was being alleged and how those were figuring into the overall picture of anti-kickback laws that we have in place related to Medicare and Medicaid payments.
Okay, what exactly was being alleged?
Let me go back and just kind of give a picture of what's going on with DaVita and what they are and who they are. You know, DaVita is, in this case, has essentially been accused of paying for referrals from physicians. You know, federal law prohibits the buying and selling of patient referrals, period. And the general thought behind it is that when a company pays a provider, practice group, or a physician for patient referrals, then it becomes more about the money than it does about the patient or the financial gains to be obtained versus the patient's well-being. DaVita provides kidney dialysis, which is typically a service that is provided for people in chronic kidney failure, also known as end-stage renal disease or ESRD. They're a nationwide company. They're a huge, huge company. They serve probably 150 to 170 dialysis patients a year and, you know, have 2,000 or 3,000 clinics across the country. When a suit of this nature drops, it's big. It's pretty big news. 60 to 70% of the dialysis services, including some lab and other minor services, represents the DaVita's total annual revenue. I mean that. So, you know, this is a big deal. A lot of money against their bottom line, and at the same time, they are active in the acquisition right now of I believe it's the Colorado Springs provider group. So, you know, could have an impact. I don't think it will, but it could have an impact on that ultimate acquisition. So, you know, lots of information going on and lots of concerns by a lot of people about these transactions that have occurred. You know, the case started on 9/11 of 09, coincidentally with the 9/11 disaster. It was filed as a whistleblower claim under seal in Colorado under the provisions of the False Claim Act. There is a guy named David Barbetta who is a former financial analyst with DaVita who worked in their mergers and acquisitions group who actually filed this claim subsequent to his leaving the company. And I guess his conscience got the better of him. I'm not sure. But nonetheless, the allegation started in 2005 and went through, I think, probably maybe February of this year, somewhere in that time frame. The government intervened in October. Judge decided that the documents did not need to be sealed any longer, and thus they became an open for review.
Did the whistleblower ever confront anyone within the company?
He has reported that he was rebuked at every opportunity when he discussed these things with upper management. He said that they one executive even told him, "Don't give me that ethics crap," quote unquote. He said he got a great deal of heat at the highest levels of the company, I believe is the way he described it. So he did bring it to their attention. He was rebuked about it, and apparently it bothered him. And he said one of the things that concerned him the most was the outward presentation of the company to the public and their internal operations. They were so diverse and so contradictory that's what led him to file his complaint. He initially indicated, I guess in an interview or maybe in a disclosure by the government, that he was thought about filing an anonymous complaint, but for fear that it would be ignored, decided he needed to step forward, and that he did back in 2009.
What type of personality did the whistleblower have?
I can't say specifically. I can give you two. I can refer you two different ways. The first is I would say that this guy saw what was going on and realized the impact of it long term. I think he was frustrated by the company's lack of concern about conducting its business in an ethical and appropriate manner, and it probably made him mad. Most whistleblowers in these types of cases will have been hurt in some particular way, whether it's they've lost their job or they get to the point where their conscience just won't let them go on. But once they leave and once they file the complaint, it's usually because they've had a real attack of conscience and can't stand it. This guy seems to be one of those who realized what was going on, didn't like it, tried to fix it, couldn't fix it, left the company, debated over what to do, and finally decided that the right thing to do was to file the complaint. As a former whistleblower, federal healthcare whistleblower, I can tell you that those characteristics are indeed true, that seeing fraud committed, not being able to fix it, not getting anybody to recognize it or deal with it does present a huge attack of conscience. And fear of the unknown be damned, it's a tough road, but it's the right road to take. And at the end of the day, whether the case is successful and you have a huge payday like this person will likely have or not, you do understand that you can sleep at night knowing that you did the right thing. And I think that's probably the most important thing to take from it, is it's about doing the right thing. And because healthcare fraud affects every single one of us because of the Medicare, Medicaid piece of the puzzle. And that's, you know, there's so much federal money tied up that it does affect us all.
So when the whistleblower came forward, what did he have that made people want to come in, investigators come in and follow up with the case and pursue it?
That's a great question. And the answer is that he came to the government with spreadsheets of sales, emails, all sorts of insight, of course, into the company itself and how it operated, so that he could talk about these things that were being accused and actually support it with underlying information that that these cases are often, these healthcare care fraud cases are often made with.
How did these financial inducements result in referrals to patients to the centers? What did they show?
What DaVita was doing is, I guess it's happened in the past, but it was pretty egregious in the fact that they had two or three different fraud schemes that they were keeping alive. One is they were forming or allowing physicians to be a part of joint ventures with DaVita in kidney dialysis centers across the country. They were also, and they would let them, they would share that ownership interest at a much lower price than fair market value, which is illegal. So you're basically giving the physicians an opportunity to buy into a very lucrative opportunity for not a reasonable amount of money. Another thing that they were doing would be to, when they wanted to buy a dialysis center, they would acquire that center from the physicians, the referring physicians, for a price that was greatly in excess of what the fair market value was for that business. Another illegal activity. And then finally, what they would do to ensure that the physicians were receiving as much juice or as much cash as they possibly could, they would manipulate the books and records of the of these joint ventures to squeeze as much cash out of them. And I think one exec even referred to it as money bag for physicians. And so the manipulation of the financial models and the profits to give the physicians more money was a huge no-no that they committed apparently routinely based on what the relator has shared.
When I was reading a bit about this, they refer to the scheme as a buy high, sell low scheme. How did that contribute to the kickbacks?
Well, that the buy high, sell low is one way of describing it. Of course, the physicians were induced financially through these three different schemes, either the allowing them into the joint venture for a cheap price, overpaying for their practices, or milking the financial models to give them more money, with the thought that there was a quid pro quo. We're going to give you all this money, and in exchange, you're going to give us these referrals. DaVita was clearly looking to expand their footprint or their market share in the Medicare-Medicaid business, which, again, makes up probably close to 80% of DaVita's revenue in this arena. This end-stage renal disease is very common in the Medicare-Medicaid arena. So the goal was to induce them to send these referrals to DaVita in exchange for the cash that DaVita was paying them to get those referrals.
Getting into the investigation itself, what are some best practices the investigator most likely used throughout the case?
Well, it certainly helps when you have a relator who can share financial spreadsheets and emails and all sorts of interesting and much-needed underlying facts. The end result of that is it allows the investigators to assemble a case in a much more efficient fashion than they would ordinarily be able to do just sifting through the data. They would have gone to look to determine what the fair market value was, so they would have a direct access to the determination of what the fair market value was, because DaVita was also buying and selling other clinics, and you know, those tools are readily available. So best practices, you know where to go, you go right to it, and you're able to assemble a case based on what you know to be the truth versus what has actually transpired based on what the relator is sharing. And this would come about through a review of financial documents that would include the merger and acquisition documents, as well as what's going on in the industry itself. I think, you know, as far as a best practice, it's kind of hard to describe because, you know, so much of this information was shared from somebody who had firsthand knowledge of the transactions, how they broke down, who was getting the money, where it was going, how they manipulated the financial models and related incentives, I guess, for the physicians.
So what were the implications of this case?
The implications for DaVita are substantial. They now must make careful analysis of its business operations, their joint venture practices, their relationships with referral sources, procedures, contractual provisions, and compliance matters to make sure that they don't have any issues which DOJ might have a concern. The other thing is that they're going to have to now make sure that their first future patient referrals to their dialysis centers are handled in an appropriate manner, and that includes having physician investors signing or executing non-compete agreements which preclude them from inducing or advising a patient to seek treatment from a competing center. So they're going to be limited in what they can do or face consequences. And the key thing in that is the non-compete agreements have been structured to bind all of the providers in a practice as opposed to just that one who is signing the agreement. It's a little unique, but it's all-encompassing, which is significant. The other thing that DaVita will have to deal with over a period of time is the implementation of a corporate integrity agreement, which is both costly, time-consuming, and quite expansive in its scope. But I'm not sure this is the first case, but if it's not the first case, it's one of the first few cases where the company has to engage or retain an independent monitor to make sure that his compliance efforts and the requirements of the corporate integrity agreement are met strictly. And that's a huge investment and a huge issue for DaVita and its and Total Renal Care, the other defendant in the case.
What can fraud examiners take away from a healthcare case like this? What are some lessons they can learn going into similar types of cases?
A case like this typically shows a fraud examiner that fraud in healthcare can exist at all levels and in a host of ways, and that there is no single way to commit fraud in the healthcare industry. It can be committed in as many different ways as you can probably think of. And this one would be a great example in the fact that one would think that a company who was buying into physician practices or buying dialysis centers and selling or divesting itself of some of its interest in its own dialysis centers would want to maximize its return and minimize its exposure while still trying to expand its footprint in the dialysis marketplace. This shows that companies who are bottom-line only oriented or cash-only oriented will go great lengths to both commit the fraud and cover it up, because one of the problems in discovering the fraud in this instance is the fact that payments to the physicians were made through the joint ventures or lumped in with the joint ventures, made it difficult to determine just on the surface, well, that looks fraudulent. But once the documents were reviewed, it became pretty clear that they were juicing the companies to give the physicians more money. So I think eyes open is the order of the day, and recognizing that schemes can take a host of avenues to get to the company to the end result.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us and talking about all of that. That wraps up another episode of Fraud Talk. You can find more episodes at acfe.com/podcast. We hope you tune in again next month.